Turkey carpet. The trap door to the cellar was in this hall, and you had to lift up a corner of the carpet to get to it, which I thought was an odd place, as the kitchen would have been more convenient, but the kitchen did not have a cellar under it. The cellar stairs were too steep for comfort, and the cellar below was divided into two parts by a half wall, the dairy on one side, which was where they kept the butter and the cheeses, and on the other side the place where they stored the wine and beer in barrels, and the apples, and the carrots and cabbages and beets and potatoes in boxes of sand in the winter, and the empty wine barrels as well. There was a window, but Nancy said I should always take a candle or a lantern, as it was quite dark below and you could trip and fall down the stairs and break your neck. We did not go down into the cellar at that time. Off the hall was the front parlor, with its own stove, and two pictures, one a family group. I suppose they were ancestors, as their faces were stiff and their dress was old-fashioned. The other, a large, fat bull with short legs. Also the piano, which was not a pianoforte, but only a straight-backed parlor piano, and the globe lamp, which took the best whale oil, brought up from the States. They did not have kerosene for lamps then. Behind that was the dining room, also with a fireplace, with silver candlesticks and the good china and plate in a locked cabinet, and a picture of dead pheasants over the mantelpiece, which I did not think would be agreeable while eating. This room connected with the parlor through a set of double doors, and was also reached by a single door from the passageway for carrying in the food from the kitchen. On the other side of the passageway was Mr. Kinnear's library, but we did not go into it at that time, as he was reading in it, and behind that was a small study or office with a desk, which was where he wrote his letters and transacted any business he might have. There was a fine staircase from the front hall, with a polished banister. We went up it, and on the second floor there was Mr. Kinnear's bedchamber with a large bedstead, and his dressing room adjoining, and a dressing table with an oval mirror, and a carved wardrobe, and in the bedchamber a picture of a woman without any clothes on a sofa, seen from the back and looking over her shoulder, with a sort of turban on her head and holding a peacock feather fan. Peacock feathers inside the house are bad luck, as everyone knows. These were only in a picture, but I never would have allowed them in any house of mine. There was another picture, also of a naked woman taking a bath, but I did not have the chance to examine it. I was a little taken aback at Mr. Kinnear having two naked women in his bedchamber, as at Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's it was mostly landscapes or flowers. Down the hall towards the back there was Nancy's own bedchamber, which was not as large, and each room had a carpet. By rights these carpets should have been beaten and cleaned and stored for the summer, but Nancy had not got around to it, being short of help. I did wonder at her chamber being on the same floor as Mr. Kinnear's. But there was no third floor to the house, nor attic, not like Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's house, which was much grander. There was also a chamber for guests, if any. At the end of the passageway was a closet, for such things as winter clothing, and a well-stocked linen cupboard with a good many shelves. And beside Nancy's bedchamber was a tiny room which she called her sewing room, and it had in it a table and a chair. After we had seen the upstairs of the house, we went back downstairs and discussed my duties, and I thought to myself it was a mercy it was the summer, as otherwise I would have had all those fires to lay and light, as well as the grates and stoves to clean and polish. And Nancy said of course I would not begin that very day, but the next one, and I would no doubt wish to retire early, as I must be wearied out. As this was indeed the case, and as the sun was setting, I did so. And then everything went on very quietly for a fortnight, says Dr. Jordan. He is reading aloud from my confession. Yes, sir, it did, I say, more or less quietly. What is everything? How did it go on? I beg your pardon, sir. What did you do every day? Oh, the usual, sir, I say. I performed my duties. You will forgive me, says Dr. Jordan. Of what did those duties consist? I look at him. He is wearing a yellow cravat with small white squares. He is not making a joke. He really does not know. Men such as him do not have to clean up the messes they make, but we have to clean up our own messes, and theirs, into the bargain. In that way they are like children, They do not have to think ahead or worry about the consequences of what they do. But it is not their fault. It is only how they are brought up. The next morning I woke at dawn. My little bedchamber was close and hot as the summer weather had begun, and it was dim also as the shutters were kept closed at night in case of intruders. The windows were closed too because of the mosquitoes and flies, and I thought that I must get a piece of muslin to put over the window, or else over my bed, and would speak to Nancy about it. I slept only in my shift because of the heat. I got out of bed and opened the window and the shutters to get some light, and turned back the bedclothes to air them. And then I put on my work dress and apron and pinned up my hair and set my cap in place. I intended to do a better job with my hair later, when I could use the mirror over the kitchen sink, there being no mirror in my room. I turned up my sleeves, slipped on my clogs, and unlatched the bedroom door. I always kept it locked, for if anyone was to break into the house, my bedchamber would be the first they would arrive at. I liked being early to rise. That way I could pretend for a little while that the house was my own. The first thing I did was I emptied my chamber pot into the slop pail, and then, with the pail, I went out by the door of the winter kitchen, noting in my mind that the floor was in need of a good scrubbing, as Nancy had let things get behind, and there was considerable mud that had been tracked in and not dealt with. The air outside in the courtyard was fresh. There was a pink glow in the east and a pearly gray mist rising from the fields. Somewhere nearby a bird was singing. I thought it was a wren, and farther off there were crows calling. In the early dawn, it is as if everything is beginning anew. The horses must have heard the kitchen door open because they whinnied, but it was not my duty to feed them or let them out to pasture, although I would have been glad to do it. The cow mooed as well, as her udder was no doubt full, but she would have to wait because I could not do everything at once. I went along the path, past the henyard and the kitchen garden, and back through the dew-sprinkled weeds, pushing aside the gauzy spider webs that were woven in the night. I would never kill a spider. Mary Whitney said it would bring bad luck, and she was not the only one to say so. When I found one inside the house, I would pick it up on the end of a broom and shake it off outside. But I must have killed some of them by accident, because I got the bad luck anyway. I reached the privy and emptied the slop pail and so forth. "And so forth, Grace?" asks Dr. Jordan. I look at him. Really, if he does not know what you do in a privy, there is no hope for him. What I did was, I hoisted my skirts and sat down above the buzzing flies on the same seat everyone in the house sat on. Lady or lady's maid, they both piss and it smells the same. And not like lilacs neither, as Mary Whitney used to say. What was in there for wiping was an old copy of Godey's Lady's Book. I always looked at the pictures before using them. Most were of the latest fashions, but some were of duchesses from England and high society ladies in New York and the like. You should never let your picture be in a magazine or a newspaper if you can help it, as you never know what ends your face may be made to serve by others once it has got out of your control. But I do not say any of this to Dr. Jordan. And so forth, I say firmly, because "and so forth" is all he is entitled to. Just because he pesters me to know everything is no reason for me to tell him. Then I carried the slop bucket to the pump in the courtyard, I say, and I primed the pump with water from the bucket that was kept there for the purpose, as with a pump you have to pour some in before you can get any out. And Mary Whitney used to say that was exactly how men viewed the flattering of a woman, when they had low ends in view. Once I had the pump going, I rinsed out the slop pail and washed my face, then cupped my hands to drink. The water from Mr. Kinnear's well was good, with no taste of iron or sulphur. By this time the sun was coming up and burning off the mist, and I could tell it was going to be a fair morning. Next I went into the summer kitchen and started the fire in the stove. I cleaned out the ashes from the day before and saved them for sprinkling into the privy, or else for the kitchen garden, where they helped to keep off the snails and slugs. The stove was a new one, but it had its own opinions, and when first lit, it threw black smoke out at me like a witch on fire. I had to coax it. I fed it bits of old newspapers. Mr. Kinnear liked his papers and took several, and also slivers of kindling, and it coughed, and I blew in through the grate, and finally the fire caught and began blazing away. The firewood was split in pieces too big for the stove, and I had to cram them in with the poker. I would have to speak to Nancy about it later, and she would speak to McDermott, who was the one responsible. Then I went out into the yard and pumped a bucketful of water and lugged it back into the kitchen and filled the kettle from it with the dipper and set it on the stove to boil. Then I got two carrots from the bin in the harness room off the winter kitchen, old carrots they were, and put them in my pocket and headed out to the barn with the milking pail. The carrots were for the horses, and I gave them furtively. They were only horse carrots, but I hadn't asked permission about them. I kept an ear out for sounds of McDermott stirring his bones up above in the loft, but there wasn't a rustle out of him. He was dead to the world, or acting it. Then I milked the cow. She was a good cow, and took to me right away. There are some cows very bad-tempered that will hook you with a horn or give you a good kick, but this was not one of them, and once I had my forehead into her flank, she settled right down to the business. The barn cats came mewing for milk, and I gave them some. Then I said good-bye to the horses, and Charlie put his head down towards my apron pocket. He knew where the carrots were kept all right. On the way out, I heard a strange noise coming from up above. It was as if someone was hammering furiously with two hammers, or beating on a wooden drum. At first I could not make it out at all, but as I listened, I realized it must be McDermott step-dancing on the bare boards of the loft. He sounded skillful enough, but why was he dancing all by himself up there, and so early in the morning? Perhaps it was from sheer joy and the overflow of animal spirits, but somehow I did not think so. I carried the milk back to the summer kitchen and took off some fresh milk for the tea. Then I covered the milk pail with a cloth because of the flies, and let it stand so the cream would rise. I wished to make butter from it later in the day if there were no thunderstorms about, as butter will not come when there's thunder. Then I took a moment to tidy my own room. It was not much of a room to speak of, not papered, and no pictures in it, nor even any curtains. I gave it a quick sweep with the broom and rinsed out the chamber pot and slid it under the bed. There were rolls of sluts wool under there, enough for a whole sheep, and you could see it hadn't been swept out for a long time. I shook up the mattress and straightened the sheets and plumped the pillow and pulled the quilt up over. It was an old, threadbare quilt, though a fine one when first made, a wild goose chase it was, and I thought of the quilts I would make for myself, after I'd saved up enough wages and was married, and with a house of my own. It gave me satisfaction to have a tidied room. When I came into it later, at the end of the day, it would be neat and trim, just as if a servant had made it up for me. Then I took the egg basket and half a pail of water and went out to the hen house. James McDermott was in the yard, sousing his dark head under the pump, but he must have heard me behind him, and as his face came up out of the water, for a moment he had a lost look to him, wild and frantic like a half-drowned child, and I wondered who he thought was in pursuit of him. But then he saw who it was, and gave a jaunty wave which was at least a friendly sign, and the first one he'd given me. I had both hands full, so merely nodded. I poured out the water for the hens into their trough, and let them out of the hen house, and while they were drinking and fighting over who was to go first, I went in and gathered the eggs, big eggs they were, it being the time of year for it. Then I scattered grain for them, and the kitchen waste from the day before. I was not fond of hens, as I have always preferred an animal with fur to a gaggle of frowsy, cackling birds scratching in the dirt. But if you want their eggs, you have to put up with their unruly ways. The rooster hacked at my ankles with his spurs to chase me away from his wives, but I gave him a kick and almost lost the clog off my foot while doing it. One rooster a flock keeps the hens happy, they say, but one was too many as far as I was concerned. "Mind your manners or I'll wring your neck," I told him, although in fact I could never bear to do anything of the sort. By this time McDermott was watching over the fence with a big grin on his face. He was better looking when smiling, I had to give him that, although he was so dark and had a rogue's twist to the mouth. But perhaps, sir, I am imagining that in view of what came later. "Would that be me you're addressing?" said McDermott. "No, it would not," I said with a cool manner as I walked by him. I thought I could tell what he had in mind, and it was not original. I did not want any of that kind of trouble, and to keep a cordial distance would be best. The kettle was boiling at last. I set the porridge pot on the stove with the porridge in it that was already soaking. Then I made the tea and left it to steep while I went out into the yard and pumped another pail of water and carried it back in, and lifted the big copper pot onto the back of the stove and filled it up, as I needed a good supply of it heated for the dirty dishes and such. At this time Nancy came in, wearing a cotton gingham dress and an apron, not a fancy dress as she'd worn the afternoon before. She said, "Good morning," and I gave it in return. "Is the tea made?" she said, and I said it was. "Oh, I feel I'm scarcely alive in the morning until I've had my cup of tea," she said, and so I poured it out for her. "Mr. Kinnear will take his tea upstairs," she said, but I already knew this, as she'd laid out the tea tray the night before with a small teapot and the cup and saucer, not the silver tray with the family crest, but one of painted wood. "And," she added, "he will want a second cup when he comes down before his breakfast, as that is his custom." I put on the fresh milk in a little jug, and the sugar, and picked up the tray. "I will take it up," said Nancy. I was surprised, and said that at Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's, the housekeeper would never have thought of carrying a tea tray up the stairs, as it was beneath her position and a job for the maids. Nancy stared at me for a moment and was not pleased, but then she said that of course she only took the tray up when short of help, and there was no one else to do it, and she'd got into the habit of it lately. So I proceeded. The door to Mr. Kinnear's bedchamber was at the top of the stairs. There was nowhere near it where I could set the tray down, so I balanced it with one arm while knocking. "Your tea, sir," I said. There was a mumbling from inside, and I went in. It was dark in the room, so I set the tray down on the low round table beside the bed and went over to the window and opened the curtains just a little. Those curtains were dark brown brocade with a satiny feel to them and a fringe, and they were soft to the touch. But in my opinion, it is better to have a white curtain, a cotton or a muslin in summer, as white does not absorb the heat and bring it into the house as much, and also it looks a good deal cooler. I could not see Mr. Kinnear, as he was in the darkest corner of the room with his face in shadow. His bed did not have a patchwork quilt, but a dark bedspread that matched the curtains. It was thrown back, and he had only the sheet over him. His voice came to me, as you might say, from underneath it. "Thank you, Grace," he said. He was always one to say please and thank you. I must say he knew how to speak. "You're welcome, sir," I said. And he was indeed welcome from my heart. I never begrudged doing things for him, and even though he paid me for doing them, it was as if I did them freely. "There's beautiful eggs this morning, sir," I said. "Would you want one of them for your breakfast?" "Yes," he says, in a hesitating way. "Thank you, Grace. I'm sure it will do me good." I did not like the way he said this, as he was talking as if he was ill, but Nancy hadn't mentioned anything about it. When I went back downstairs, I said to Nancy, "Mr. Kinnear wants an egg for his breakfast." And she said, "I will take one also. He will have his fried with bacon, but I cannot eat a fried egg. Mine should be boiled. We will have breakfast together in the dining room, as he requires me to keep him company. He does not like to eat alone." I found this a little curious, though not unheard of. Then I said, "Is Mr. Kinnear ill at all?" Nancy laughed a little and said, "Sometimes he fancies he is, but it's all just in his head. He wants to be fussed over." "I wonder why he never married," I said, "a fine man like him." I was getting out the frying pan for the eggs, and it was just an idle question. I did not mean anything by it. But she replied in an angry tone, or it sounded angry to me. "Some gentlemen do not have an inclination for the married state," she said. "They are very pleased with themselves the way they are, and think they can get along well enough without it." "I suppose they can at that," I said. "Certainly they can, if rich enough," she said. "If they want a thing, all they have to do is pay for it. It's all one to them." Now, here is the first falling out that I had with Nancy. It was when I was doing up Mr. Kinnear's room on the first day, and I had my bed apron on to keep the dirt and smuts from the stove away from the white sheets. Nancy was hovering about and telling me where the things were to be put and how to tuck in the corners of the sheets, and how to air out Mr. Kinnear's nightshirt, and how his brushes and dressing things were to be laid out on the dressing table, and how often the silver backs of them should be polished, in which of the shelves he liked to have his folded shirts and his linens put on, ready for wearing, and she was acting as if I had never done any of these things before. And I reflected then, as I have done since, that it is harder to work for a woman who has once been a servant herself than one who has not, because those who have been servants will have their own ways of doing things, and they will also know the shortcuts, such as the dropping of a few dead flies down behind the bedstead, or the sweeping of a little sand or dust under the carpet, which would never be noticed unless those places were closely inspected, and they will have sharper eyes, and will be more likely to find you out in such manners. Not that I was such a slattern as a rule, but we all have days when we are in a hurry. And when I would say about a thing that this was not the way it was done at Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's, Nancy replied sharply that she did not care, as I was not at Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's now. She didn't like to be reminded that I'd once worked in such a grand house and mixed with better than her, but I have thought since that the reason for all her fussing was that she did not wish to leave me by myself in Mr. Kinnear's room alone, in case he should come into it. To take her mind off her fidgeting, I asked her about the picture on the wall, not the one with the peacock feather fan, but the other one, of a young lady taking a bath in a garden, which was an odd place for it, with her hair tied up and a maid holding a large towel ready for her, and several old men with beards peering at her from behind the bushes. I could tell by the clothing that it was in ancient times. Nancy said it was an engraving, and that the colouring was done by hand, and it was a copy of a famous painting about Susanna and the elders, which was a Bible subject, and she was very proud of knowing so much. But I was annoyed with her because of all the picking and carping she had been doing, and I said I knew my Bible backwards and forwards, which was not far from the truth, and that this was not one of the stories in it, so it could not be a Bible subject. And she said it was, and I said it wasn't, and I was willing to have it put to the test. And she said I was not there to argue about pictures, but to make the bed. And at that moment Mr. Kinnear came into the room. He must have been listening in the passageway, as he seemed amused. "What?" he said. "Are you discussing theology, and so early in the morning, too?" And he wanted to be told all about it. Nancy said it was nothing for him to be bothered about, but he still desired to know, and said, "Well, Grace, I see Nancy wishes to keep it a secret from me, but you must tell me." And I was shy, but at length I asked him whether the picture was of a biblical subject, as Nancy had said. And he laughed, and said that, strictly speaking, it was not, as the story was in the Apocrypha. And I was surprised, and asked what that might be, and I could tell that Nancy had never heard the word before either, but she was put out because she'd been wrong, and was frowning in a sulky manner. Mr. Kinnear said I was very inquisitive for such a young person, and soon he would have the most learned maidservant in Richmond Hill, and he would have to put me on display and charge money for me, like the mathematical pig in Toronto. Then he said the Apocrypha was a book where they'd put all the stories from biblical times that they decided should not go into the Bible. I was most astonished to hear this, and I said, "Who decided?" Because I'd always thought that the Bible was written by God, as it was called the Word of God, and everyone termed it so. And he smiled and said that though perhaps God wrote it, it was men who wrote it down, which was a little different. But those men were said to have been inspired, which meant that God had spoken to them and told them what to do. So I asked, did they hear voices? And he said yes, and I was glad that someone else had done so, although I said nothing about it. And in any case, the voice I had heard that one time had not been God's, but Mary Whitney's. He asked me if I knew the story of Susanna, and I said no. And he said she was a young lady who had been falsely accused of sinning with a young man by some old men, because she refused to commit the very same sin with them, and she would have been executed by being stoned to death, but luckily she had a clever lawyer who was able to prove that the old men had been lying by inducing them to give contradictory evidence. Then he said, "What did I think the moral of it was?" And I said the moral was that you should not take baths outside in the garden. And he laughed, and said he thought the moral was that you needed a clever lawyer. And he said to Nancy, "This girl is no simpleton after all," by which I guessed she had been telling him that I was one. And Nancy looked daggers at me. Then he said he'd found a shirt ironed and put away with a button missing, and that it was very aggravating to put on a clean shirt, only to find that you couldn't do it up properly because of a lack of buttons. And would we please mind that it did not happen again? And he took up his gold snuff box, which was what he'd come for, and went out of the room. But now Nancy had been in the wrong twice, for that shirt must have been washed and ironed by her before I was ever anywhere near. And so she gave me a list of chores as long as your arm, and went flouncing out of the room and down the stairs and out into the yard, and began scolding McDermott for not cleaning her shoes properly that morning. I said to myself that there was trouble ahead, and I would have to guard my tongue, because Nancy did not like being crossed, and most of all she did not like being put in the wrong by Mr. Kinnear. When she hired me away from Watson's, I thought we would be like sisters, or at least good friends, the two of us working together side by side, as I had done with Mary Whitney. Now I knew that this was not the way things were going to be. I had now been a servant for 3 years, and could act the part well enough by that time. But Nancy was very changeable, two-faced, you might call her, and it wasn't easy to tell what she wanted from 1 hour to the next. 1 minute she would be up on her high horse and ordering me about and finding fault, and the next minute she would be my best friend, or pretend to be, and would put her arm through mine and say I looked tired and should sit down with her and have a cup of tea. It's much harder to work for such a person. It's just when you are curtsying and mamming them, they turn around and upbraid you for being so stiff and formal, and want to confide in you and expect the same in return. You cannot ever do the correct thing with them. The next day was a fine, fair day with a breeze, and so I did the wash, and high time, too, as clean things were running short. It was hot work, as I had to keep the fire in the summer kitchen stove going at a brisk rate, and I'd had no chance to sort and soak the things the night before. But I could not risk waiting, as at that time of year there could be a quick change in the weather. So I scrubbed and rubbed, and got it all hung up nicely at last, with the napkins and the white pocket handkerchiefs neatly spread out on the grass to bleach. There were snuff stains and ink stains and grass stains on a petticoat of Nancy's. I wondered how she'd got them, but she had most likely slipped and fallen down. And several spots of mildew on things that had been in the dampness at the bottom of the pile, and wine stains on the tablecloth from a supper party, which had not been covered with salt at the time, as they should have been, but by dint of a good bleaching fluid made from lye and chloride of lime, which I'd learned from the laundress at Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's, I got them out mostly, and trusted to the sunlight to do the rest. I stood for a moment admiring my handiwork, for there is a great deal of pleasure to be had in a wash all clean and blowing in the wind like pennants at a race or the sails of a ship, and the sound of it is like the hands of the heavenly hosts applauding, though heard from far away. And they do say that cleanliness is next to godliness, and sometimes, when I've seen the pure white clouds billowing in the sky after a rain, I used to think that it was as if the angels themselves were hanging out there washing. For I reasoned that someone must do it, as everything in heaven must be very clean and fresh. But these were childish fancies, as children like to tell themselves stories about things that are not visible. And I was scarcely more than a child at the time, although I thought myself a grown woman, having my own money that I earned myself. While I was standing there, Jamie Walsh came around the corner of the house and asked if there were any errands to be run, and he said to me, quite shyly, that if he was sent into the village by Nancy or Mr. Kinnear, and if there was any little thing I should want, he would be glad to buy the same for me and fetch it back if I would give him the money. Although awkward, he was as polite as he knew how to be, and even removed his hat, which was an old straw one and had been his father's most likely, as it was too big for him. I said it was thoughtful of him, but that I did not need anything at the moment. And then I remembered there was no ox gall in the house for setting the dyes in the wash, and I would need some to do the dark colors, for the things I had done that morning had been all white. I went with him to Nancy, and she had several other items for him to buy, and Mr. Kinnear had a message to be delivered to one of his gentleman friends, and so off he went. Nancy told him to come back in the afternoon and bring his flute with him, and when he was gone she said that he played so beautiful it was a pleasure to hear it. She was in a good temper again by this time, and helped me get the dinner, which was a cold one, with ham and pickles, and a salad from the kitchen garden, for there were lettuces and chives to be had. But she ate in the dining room with Mr. Kinnear, as before, and I had to make do with McDermott for my own company. It is uncomfortable watching another person eat, and listening to them as well, especially if they have a tendency to guzzle. But McDermott did not seem inclined to conversation, having reverted to a sullen mood. So I asked him whether he enjoyed dancing. "What makes you ask that?" he said suspiciously. And not wanting to let on that I'd been overhearing him at his practice, I said it was known of him that he was a good dancer. He said maybe he was and maybe he wasn't, but he seemed pleased. And so then I set to work to draw him out, and asked him about his own life before he came to work at Mr. Kinnear's. He said, who would care to hear about that? I said that I would, as all such stories were of interest to me, and he soon began to tell. He said his family was respectable enough, being from Waterford in the south of Ireland, and his father had been a steward, but he himself had been a scapegrace, and never one to lick the boots of the rich, and was always getting into mischief, which he appeared rather proud of than otherwise. I asked him if he had a mother living, and he said whether he did or didn't it was all the same to him, as she'd had a bad opinion of him and told him he was going straight to the devil, and she could be dead for all he knew or cared about it. But his voice was not so sturdy as his words. He'd run away from home at a young age, and joined the army in England, claiming he was several years older than he was, but it being too hard a life to his mind, and too much discipline and hard treatment, he deserted, and stowed away on a ship bound for America, and when discovered, he'd worked out the rest of his passage, but had landed in Canada East, rather than in the United States. And then he'd got a job on the boats that plied up and down the St. Lawrence River, and then on the lake boats, which were glad to have him, as he was very strong, with a grand lot of endurance, and could work without stopping, just like a steam engine, and that was well enough for a time. But it became too monotonous, and as he had a love of variety, he'd enlisted again for a soldier, with the Glengarry Light Infantry, which had got such a bad reputation among the farmers, as I knew from Mary Whitney, having burnt a good many farmhouses during the rebellion, and turned women and children out into the snow, and done worse to them besides, that was never printed in the papers. So they were an unruly bunch of men, and given to dissipation, and to gaming and drink and the like, which he accounted manly virtues. But the rebellion was over by then, and there was not much to be done. And McDermott was not a regular soldier, but acted as personal servant to Captain Alexander MacDonald. It was a soft life with decent pay, and he was sorry when that regiment was disbanded, and he was thrown on his own resources. He went to Toronto and lived idly on the money he had saved. But then his funds dwindled, and he knew he would have to look about him. And it was in search of a position that he'd gone north up Young Street and had come as far as Richmond Hill. He'd heard in one of the taverns that Mr. Kinnear was in need of a man, and had presented himself, and it was Nancy that hired him. But he thought he would be working for the gentleman himself, and doing for him in person as he had for Captain MacDonald, but was annoyed to find that a woman was set over him instead, and one who never gave him a moment's rest from her tongue and found fault constantly. I believed all he said, but afterwards, when I added up the times in my head, I felt he must be several years older than the 21 he gave himself, either that or he'd been lying. And when I heard later from others in the neighbourhood, including Jamie Walsh, that McDermott had a strong reputation as a liar and a braggart, I was not at all surprised. Then I began to think I'd been wrong to show such an interest in his story, as he had mistaken this for an interest in his person. Having had several glasses of beer, he now began to make sheep's eyes at me, and asked if I had a sweetheart, as a pretty girl like me might be expected to have one. I should have replied that my sweetheart was 6 feet tall and an expert at boxing, but I was too young to know any better, so instead I told the truth. I said I did not have a sweetheart, and furthermore I had no inclinations that way. He said that was a pity, but there was a first time for everything, and I only needed breaking in like a colt, and then I would go as good as the rest of them, and he was the man for the job. I was very annoyed by this, and got up at once and began to clear the dishes with a great clattering, and said I would thank him to keep such offensive remarks to himself, as I was not a mare. Then he said he didn't mean it, that it was all in fun, and he just wanted to see what sort of girl I might be. I said what sort of girl I might be was not any business of his, at which he became quite sulky, as if I was the one who had insulted him, and went out into the courtyard and began to chop the firewood. After I'd washed up the dishes, which had to be done carefully because of all the flies about, which would walk on the clean dishes if not covered up by a cloth and leave their dirty fly specks, and after I'd been outside to see how my laundry was drying, and had sprinkled the pocket handkerchiefs and table napkins with water to make them bleach out better, then it was time to skim the cream off the milk and to make the butter. I did this outside, in the shade cast by the house to get some air, and as the churn was the kind that worked by a foot pedal, I was able to sit in a chair while doing it and attend to some of the mending at the same time. Some people have churns that are worked by a dog, which is penned up in a cage and made to run on a treadmill with a hot coal under its tail, but I consider this to be cruel. While I was sitting there waiting for the butter to come, and sewing a button onto one of Mr. Kinnear's shirts, Mr. Kinnear himself came past me on his way to the stable. I made to get up, but he told me to remain where I was, as he would rather have good butter than a curtsy. "Always busy, I see, Grace," he said. "Yes, sir," I said. "The devil finds work for idle hands to do." He laughed and said, "I trust you do not mean me, as my hands are idle enough, but not nearly devilish enough for my liking." And I was confused and said, "Oh, no, sir, I did not mean you." And he smiled and said it was becoming for a young woman to blush. There was no reply to that, so I said nothing. And he went on past, and shortly he came by on Charlie and rode down the drive. Nancy had come out to see how I was getting on with the butter, and I asked where Mr. Kinnear was going. "To Toronto," she said. "He goes there every Thursday and stays overnight to do some business at the bank and also some errands. But first he will go to Colonel Bridgeford's, whose wife is away from home and the two daughters as well, so he can visit safely. But when she is there, he is not received." I was surprised at this and asked why. And Nancy said that Mr. Kinnear was considered a bad influence by Mrs. Bridgeford, who thought she was the Queen of France, and that nobody else was fit to lick her shoes. And she laughed, but she did not sound very amused. "Why, what has he done?" I asked. But just then I could feel the butter coming. There is a thick feel to it. So I did not pursue it. Nancy helped me with the butter, and we salted the most of it, covered it in cold water to store, and pressed some fresh into the molds. Two had a thistle design, and the third had the Kinnear crest, with the motto, "I live in hope." Nancy said that if Mr. Kinnear's elder brother in Scotland was to die, who was really only a half-brother, then Mr. Kinnear would come into a big house and lands there. But she said he was not expecting it, and claimed to be happy enough as he was, or that was what he said when feeling in good health. But there was no love lost between him and the half-brother, which is usual in such cases, and I guessed that Mr. Kinnear had been packed off to the colonies to get him out of the way. When we had the butter done, we carried it down the cellar stairs into the dairy, but we left some of the buttermilk above to make into biscuits later. Nancy said she didn't much like the cellar, as it always smelled of earth and of mice and old vegetables, and I said that perhaps it could be given a good airing out some day if we could get the window open. And we went back upstairs, and after I'd gathered in my washing, we sat outside on the veranda, mending away together like the best friends in the world. Later, I came to notice that she was always affability itself when Mr. Kinnear was not present, but jumpy as a cat when he was, and when I was in the same room with him. But I was not aware of it then. As we sat there, along came McDermott, running along the top of the snake fence, agile as a squirrel, and zigging and zagging. I was amazed, and said, "What on earth is he doing?" And Nancy said, "Oh, he does that sometimes. He says it is for the exercise, but really he just wants to be admired. You should not pay any attention." And so I pretended not to. But secretly I watched, as he was in reality very nimble. And after he had run back and forth, he jumped down, and then leapt entirely over the fence, using only one hand on it to steady himself. So there I was, pretending not to watch. And there he was, pretending not to be watched. And you may see the very same thing, sir, at any polite gathering of society ladies and gentlemen. There is a good deal that can be seen slantwise, especially by the ladies who do not wish to be caught staring. They can also see through veils and window curtains and over the tops of fans, and it is a good thing they can see in this way or they would never see much of anything. But those of us who do not have to be bothered with all the veils and fans manage to see a good deal more. In a little time, Jamie Walsh appeared. He'd come through the fields and had brought his flute with him as requested. Nancy greeted him warmly and thanked him for coming. She sent me to fetch Jamie a mug of beer, and while I was drawing it, McDermott came in and said he would have one too. Then I could not resist and said, "I did not know you had monkey blood in you. You was leaping about like one." And he did not know whether to be pleased that I had seen him, or angry at being called a monkey. He said that when the cat was away, the mice would play, and when Kinnear was in town, then Nancy always liked her little parties, and he supposed the Walsh boy would now be screeching on his tin whistle, and I said that was quite right, and I would give myself the pleasure of hearing it, and he said that to his mind it was no pleasure, and I said he could suit himself. At that he caught hold of my arm and looked at me very earnestly, and said he hadn't meant to offend me before, and having been so long among rough men whose manners were not of the best, he was inclined to forget himself and did not know how to speak, and he hoped I would forgive him and that we could be friends. I said I was always ready to be friends with any who were sincere, and as for forgiveness, was it not ordained in the Bible? And I certainly hoped that I could forgive, as I myself hope to be forgiven in future, which I said very calm. After that I took the beer to the front veranda and some bread and cheese for our supper to have with it, and I sat out there with Nancy and Jamie Walsh while the sun declined and it became too dark to sew. It was a lovely and windless evening, and the birds were twittering, and the trees in the orchard near the road were golden in the late sunlight, and the purple milkweed flowers that grew beside the drive smelled very sweetly, and also the last few peonies beside the veranda and the climbing roses. And the coolness came down out of the air while Jamie sat and played on his flute so plaintively it did your heart good. After a while McDermott came skulking around the side of the house like a tamed wolf, and leant against the side of the house, and listened also. And there we were, in a kind of harmony, and the evening was so beautiful that it made a pain in my heart, as when you cannot tell whether you are happy or sad, and I thought that if I could have a wish, it would be that nothing would ever change, and we could stay that way forever. But the sun cannot be stopped in its path except by God, and he has done that only once, and will not do it again until the end of the world. And on this night it went down as usual, leaving behind it a deep red sunset, and for a few moments the front of the house was all pink with it. Then in the dusk the fireflies came out, for it was their time of year, and they shone in the low bushes and grasses, on and then off, like stars glimpsed through a cloud. Jamie Walsh caught one in a glass tumbler and held his hand over the top so I could see it up close. It flashed slowly with a cool greenish fire, and I thought if I could have two fireflies on my ears for earrings, I would not care at all about Nancy's gold ones. Then the darkness deepened and came out from behind the trees and bushes and up through the fields, and the shadows lengthened and joined together, and I thought it looked like water coming up through the ground and rising slowly up like the sea, and I fell into a reverie, and was remembering back to the time I crossed the great ocean, and how at that time of day the sea and the sky were the same indigo, so you could not tell where the one left off and the other one began, and into my memory there floated an iceberg, as white could be, and despite the warmth of the evening I felt a chill. But then Jamie Walsh said he must be getting home as his father would be looking for him, and I remembered I had not milked the cow or shut up the hens for the night, and hurried to do both by last light. When I came back into the kitchen Nancy was still there and had lighted a candle. I asked why she hadn't gone to bed, and she said she was afraid to sleep alone when Mr. Kinnear was not at home, and would I sleep upstairs with her? I said I would, but asked what she was afraid of. Was it robbers, or... perhaps, I said, she was afraid of James McDermott, but I meant it as a joke. She said archly that from what she could make out from the look in his eyes, I had more cause to be afraid of him than she did, unless I was in need of a new beau. And I said I was more afraid of the old rooster in the henyard than I was of him, and as for beaus, I had no more use for them than the man in the moon. And so she laughed, and the two of us went up to bed in a very companionable fashion, but I made sure that all was locked up first. 8. Fox and Geese. Everything went on very quietly for a fortnight, except the housekeeper several times scolding McDermott for not doing his work properly, and she gave him a fortnight's warning, He often after this told me he was glad he was going, as he did not wish any longer to live with a parcel of whores, but would have satisfaction before he went, and he told me he was positive that Kinnear and the housekeeper Nancy slept together. I was determined to find it out, and I was afterwards convinced that they did so, for her bed was never slept in except when Mr. Kinnear was absent, and then I slept with her. Confession of Grace Marks, Star and Transcript, Toronto, November 1843. Grace Marks was a pretty girl and very smart about her work, but of a silent, sullen temper. It was very difficult to know when she was pleased. After the work of the day was over, she and I were generally left to ourselves in the kitchen, the housekeeper being entirely taken up with her master. Grace was very jealous of the difference made between her and the housekeeper, whom she hated, and to whom she was often very insolent and saucy. "What is she better than us?" she would say, "that she is to be treated like a lady and eat and drink of the best. She is not better born than we are, or better educated." The good looks of Grace had interested me in her cause, and though there was something about the girl that I could not exactly like, I had been a very lawless, dissipated fellow, and if a woman was young and pretty, I cared very little about her character. Grace was sullen and proud, and not very easily won over to my purpose, but in order to win her liking, if possible, I gave a ready ear to all her discontented repinings. James McDermott, to Kenneth Mackenzie, as retold by Susanna Moody, Life in the Clearings, 1853. Yet half I seem to recognize some trick of mischief happened to me, God knows when, in a bad dream, perhaps. Here ended, then, progress this way, when in the very nick of giving up, one time more came a click as when a trap shuts. You're inside the den. Robert Browning, Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came, 1855. Today when I woke up, there was a beautiful pink sunrise, with a mist lying over the fields like a white soft cloud of muslin, and the sun shining through the layers of it all blurred and rosy like a peach gently on fire. In fact, I have no idea of what kind of sunrise there was. In prison, they make the windows high up so you cannot climb out of them, I suppose, but also so you cannot see out of them either, or at least not onto the outside world. They do not want you looking out. They do not want you thinking the word out. They do not want you looking at the horizon and thinking you might some day drop below it yourself, like the sail of a ship departing, or a horse and rider vanishing down a far hillside. And so, this morning, I saw only the usual form of light, a light without shape, coming in through the high up and dirty grey windows, as if cast by no sun and no moon, and no lamp or candle. Just a swathe of daylight, the same all the way through like lard. I took off my prison nightdress, which was coarse-woven and of a yellowed color. I should not say it was mine, because we own nothing here and share all in common, like the early Christians. And the nightdress you wear one week next to your skin while you sleep may 2 weeks previous have been lying close to the heart of your worst enemy, and washed and mended by others who do not wish you well. As I dressed myself and tidied back my hair, there was a tune going through my head, a little song that Jamie Walsh used to play sometimes upon his flute. Tom, Tom, the piper's son, stole a pig and away he run, and all the tune that he could play was Over the Hills and Far Away. I knew I'd remembered it wrong, and the real song said the pig was eat and Tom was beat, and then went howling down the street. But I didn't see why I shouldn't make it come out in a better way. And as long as I told no one of what was in my mind, there was no one to hold me to account or correct me, just as there was no one to say that the real sunrise was nothing like the one I'd invented for myself, but instead only a soiled yellowish white, like a dead fish floating in the harbor. At least in the lunatic asylum you could see out better, when you were not muffled up in a darkened room. Before breakfast there was a whipping out in the courtyard. They do it before breakfast, as if those being whipped have eaten first, they are likely to spew up their food, and that makes a mess, as well as being a waste of good nourishment. And the keepers and guards say they like the exercise at that time of day, as it gives them an appetite. It was only a routine whipping and nothing unusual, so we were not summoned to watch it. Two or three only, and all of them men. The women do not get whipped so frequently. The first was young by the tenor of his screaming. I can tell these things, having had a good deal of practice. I tried not to listen, and thought instead about the pig that was stolen by Tom the thief, and how it got eaten. But the song did not say who ate it, whether it was Tom himself or those who caught him. Set a thief to catch a thief, as Mary Whitney used to say. I wondered, was it a dead pig to begin with? Most likely not. Most likely it had a rope around its neck or a ring through its nose and was forced to run away with Tom. That would make the most sense, as it would save the carrying of it. In the whole song, the poor pig was the only one who did no wrong, but it was also the only one who died. Many songs I have noticed are unfair in this way. At breakfast, all was silent except for the munching of bread and the slurping of tea and the shuffling of feet and the snuffling of noses, and the drone of the Bible being read out, which today was Jacob and Esau, and the mess of pottage, and the lies that were told, and the blessing and the birthright that was sold, and the deceptions and disguises that were practiced, which God did not mind at all, but the contrary. Just as old Isaac was feeling his hairy son, which was not his son at all, but a skinned goat, Annie Little gave me a hard pinch on the thigh, under the table where it could not be seen. I knew what she was about. She wanted to make me scream so I would be punished, or else thought to be having another attack of insanity. But I was ready for her, as I was expecting something of the sort. In the washhouse yesterday, as we stood at the sink, she leant over and whispered to me, "Doctor's pet, spoiled whore," because the word has gone round, and all know about the visits of Dr. Jordan, and some think I am having too much attention paid to me, and have grown proud with it. If they think that here, they will take you down a peg or two. And it would not be the first time, as they resent my service in the governor's house as well, but they're afraid to act too openly, thinking I might have the ear of some in power. There's no place like a prison for small jealousies, and I've seen some come to blows, and even close to murder, over nothing more than a piece of cheese. But I knew better than to complain of her to the matrons. Not only do they view such tale-tellers with disgust, preferring a quiet life for themselves, but they also might not believe me, or might say they did not, as the warden says a convict's word is not sufficient evidence. And then, too, Annie Little would be sure to be revenged on me in some other way. One ought to bear all patiently, as part of the correction we are subject to, unless a way can be found of tripping up your enemy without detection. Hair-pulling is not advisable, as the racket brings the keepers, and then both sides are punished for creating a disturbance. Dirt slipped into the food by means of the sleeve, as with magicians, may be accomplished without much fuss, and may bring some satisfaction. But Annie Little was in the asylum with me, her crime being manslaughter, having struck and killed a stable boy with a log of wood, and she was said to suffer from nervous excitement, and was sent back here at the same time as me, but should not have been, as I do not think she's right in the head. So I resolved to forgive her this time, unless she did worse. And the pinch appeared to have relieved her feelings. Then it was time for the keepers, and our walk out through the gate. Ah, Grace, out for your promenade with your two beaus, ain't you the lucky one? Oh, no, we're the lucky ones. We're the lucky boys ourselves, with such a morsel on our arms, says the one. What do you say, Grace? Says the other. Let's just nip up a side alley, into a back stable, down on the hay. It won't take long if you lie still, and quicker yet if you wiggle about. Or why lie down at all, says the one. Back her up against the wall, and heave-ho, and hoist the petticoats. It's a quick jump standing up, as long as your knees don't give out on you. Come, Grace, just give us the word, and we're your lads. One as good as the other, and why settle for one when there's two standing ready? Standing ready all the time. Here, give us a hand, and you can test the truth of it. Nor we won't charge you a penny, neither, says the other. What's a good time between old friends? You're no friends of mine, I say, with your filthy talk. You were born in the gutter, and you'll die in it, too. Oh-ho, says the one. That's what I like, a little high spirits in a woman, a little fire. They say it comes with the redness of the hair. But is it red where it most counts? Says the other. A fire in a treetop is no use at all. It must be in a fireplace to cast enough heat, in a little cook stove. You know why God made women with skirts? It's so they could be pulled up over their heads and tied at the top. That way you don't get so much noise out of them. I hate a screeching slut. Women should be born without mouths on them. The only thing of use in them is below the waist. Shame on you, says I, as we walk around a puddle and across the street. To talk that way, your own mother was a woman, or at least I suppose she was. And bad cess to her, says the one, the whoring old witch. The only part of me she ever liked to see was my bare bum covered with red stripes. She's burning in hell this moment, and I'm only sorry it wasn't me put her there, but a drunken sailor whose pocket she tried to pick, and who knocked her on the head with a bottle. Well, says the other, my own mother was an angel, to be sure. A saint on earth, according to her own reckoning, and would never let me forget it, and I don't know which is worse. I'm a philosopher, says the one. It's moderation for me, not too thin and not too fat, and best not to waste God's gifts to us. Speaking of which, Grace, you're ripe enough to be picked. Why stay on the tree untasted? You'll just fall off and rot at the foot of it in any case. True enough, says the other. Why let the milk go sour in the bowl? A sweet nut should be cracked while there's still some goodness in it, as there's nothing worse than a fusty old nut. Come, you're making my mouth water for you already. You're enough to turn an honest man into a cannibal. I'd like to get a strong grip on you with my teeth, just what you might call a nibble, a small bite out of the ham end. You'd not miss it. You've enough on you and to spare. Right you are, says the one. Look. She's got a waist like a willow, but she's taking on fat below. It's all the fine cooking they do at the prison. Cream-fed she is. Would you just take a feel of it? That's a haunch fit for the Pope's own table. And he took to kneading and prodding, with the one hand that was hidden by the folds of my gown. I'll thank you not to take liberties, I say, pulling away. I'm all for liberties myself, says the one. Being a Republican at heart, having no use for the Queen of England except what nature intended, and though she's got a fine pair of bosoms on her, and I'd pay her the compliment of giving them a squeeze at any time she might request it, she's got no chin to her at all, no more than a duck. And what I say is, no man is better than the next, and it's share and share alike and none preferred. And once you've given it out to one of us, why then, the others must all take their turns like true Democrats. And why should that little runt McDermott be allowed to enjoy what is denied to his betters? Yes, said the other. You gave him liberties enough. A fine time you had of it, I've no doubt, with him sweating away at it all night in the tavern in Lewiston, with barely a pause to refresh himself, for they say he was a prime athlete, and a dab hand with the axe as well, and could climb up a rope like a monkey. Alias Grace by Margaret Atwood. Read by Shelley Thompson. Then it was time for the keepers, and our walk out through the gate. Ah, Grace, out for your promenade with your two beaus, ain't you the lucky one? Oh, no, we're the lucky ones. We're the lucky boys ourselves, with such a morsel on our arms, says the one. What do you say, Grace? Says the other. Let's just nip up a side alley, into a back stable, down on the hay. It won't take long if you lie still, and quicker yet if you wiggle about. Or why lie down at all, says the one. Back her up against the wall, and heave-ho, and hoist the petticoats. It's a quick jump standing up, as long as your knees don't give out on you. Come, Grace, just give us the word, and we're your lads. One as good as the other, and why settle for one when there's two standing ready? Standing ready all the time. Here, give us a hand, and you can test the truth of it. Nor we won't charge you a penny, neither, says the other. What's a good time between old friends? You're no friends of mine, I say, with your filthy talk. You were born in the gutter, and you'll die in it too. Oh-ho, says the one. That's what I like, a little high spirits in a woman, a little fire. They say it comes with the redness of the hair. But is it red where it most counts? Says the other. A fire in a treetop is no use at all. It must be in a fireplace to cast enough heat, in a little cook stove. You know why God made women with skirts? It's so they could be pulled up over their heads and tied at the top. That way you don't get so much noise out of them. I hate a screeching slut. Women should be born without mouths on them. The only thing of use in them is below the waist. Shame.